hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. Currently off to Asia Minor with my good friend David Gillespie Pratt. How are you, David?
I'm doing very well, enjoying the sandy plains. Just avoid the photographic backdrop that's just slightly in the background.
And I believe we're seeing an enormous horse behemoth coming towards us now, rolling across the plains.
Yeah, we're just going to take it inside, you know, just ignore it.
I've heard it on good authority, you know, that the Greek army has sailed away.
They're fine. There's not a whole load of, you know, massive blokes in armour, you know, kind of huddled together in there. That is definitely someone's idea of a perfect night out.
Is there? I'm getting in then. Do you know? The only downside is that
Hartnell's in there as well.
Well, you know, what happens in the Great Horse of Troy stays in the Great Horse of Troy.
A load of Greeks in battle armor in close quarters. I'm sure the Doctor would have loved that. The current Doctor probably would have enjoyed that, probably more.
Oh, boy. And I met him this week, so I can tell you, the Greeks wouldn't be complaining either.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to the Christmas special. I know some people have already seen it.
It's fantastic. It is really great. It feels like a bold new dawn, you know, for the show.
I think because us mere mortals have just had the musical number. It is currently sailing up the charts as we're approaching Christmas. And the idea that the Goblin song might be even close to getting to be a number one single is just insane.
It's about eating babies.
It's a good retort to the Doctor Who is Dead hashtag.
Yes, indeed. So are the ratings, which are now, you know, 8.7 million or something for the Star Beast.
I think, you know, because it dropped like 500,000 or something. It's like, Doctor Who is Dead. And like, you know, maybe what will you say about the Myth Makers? Because, you know, as we said, the ratings dropped, the audience appreciation is bad. But I imagine a lot of them would probably, you know, if we said, oh, Death of a Spies turned up, they would probably have, they'd probably wet themselves at the prospect of it.
I don't actually think numbers ever equate quality, ever. Because if you look at some of the lowest rated Doctor Who stories, are some of the best considered Doctor Who stories some of the time, like the War Games and things like that. Yeah?
The War Games, no one like the seasons 25 and 26, where, you know, it was getting its act together and it was starting to actually try to do something different. And also, sometimes the highest viewing figures doesn't necessarily guarantee quality.
No, I mean, look at the Web Planet, for God's sakes.
I know. Boy, I quite like Voyage of the Damned, but it's not everybody's favourite Christmas.
No, festival. Yeah. Well, Next Doctor, that got 13 million.
You know, so this...
Look at A Christmas Carol. That got 13 million. Oh, it's abysmal.
All that singing?
I don't. Oh, God. Let's not go into that. I'll end up upsetting Fraser Gregory too much.
We don't want to upset anybody with these podcasts. We want to keep it light and entertaining. And that's why we'll probably, you know, do a Capaldi next, you know, because that's going to be great fun. A Capaldi Moffat script.
I promise to keep it light and entertaining until the end, where there's a possibility I may murder you horribly.
That's fine, because, you know, basically then you'll just run away. And then, you know, next week, I'm sure things will be wonderful and happy and light and joyous when the nightmare begins.
Sure. Well, look, I've got a question for you.
Go for it.
And that is, I feel like this is a Blackadder episode 25 years early, in that it's taking a historical period. I know it's a myth, but it's taking a historical period and it's doing something very characterful and witty with it. And I was watching this and I knew that Rob Sherman had made the allusion about this being like Blackadder in Running Through Corridors. And I was watching it going, yeah, I could see Rowan Atkinson in this. I could see Hugh Laurie in this.
Well, we were saying Hugh Laurie is kind of in this in Paris. Yeah. And I think you could imagine Stephen Fry being King Priam.
And I'd love to see Miranda Richardson have a go at Cassandra.
It is very Blackadder-like, because like Blackadder 2, Blackadder Goes Forth, they both have slightly bleak endings.
They do, yeah.
You know, they know when the comedy stops. I mean, maybe not so much Blackadder 2, that's just kind of a punchline. But certainly Blackadder Goes Forth, it's like, it becomes very serious in the last episode, the last 10 minutes particularly. So I think that there's merit in that. I think it is, and it has got similar sort of humor. It's clever humor, but
It's the wit is all there in the dialogue,
it's
isn't it?
witty, and they're not play and are they playing it kind of classically, or they're playing it because there's some bits where we're talking about Paris in episode two when he's kind of like, that's not the done thing, you know, that's not
I
theatrical,
don't think so at
that's
all.
more modern, more modern.
Like you said, with the camera script being quick edits, I think they're playing it very quick as well, like a modern day comedy, like a modern day soap opera that would be played very fast, sort of Hancock, that sort of thing at the time, where the dialogue exchanges are back and forth,
I
you
wonder
know?
if that was one of the directions they were given, which is play it like a sitcom.
Yeah, these historical dramas are a bit drab. Let's beef them up a bit, you know?
And I think because there was a story when they were doing I, Claudius, where I think when they started recording, the actors struggled to get into it. And I think I can't remember what the direction was, but they found it was like, is it basically, it's not a Roman thing, is it? Is it basically just a family
Yeah.
comedy drama? Like, yes. And that's when they started to, you know, they played it, they didn't play it all thesp like. You play it more, not real, because it's not, these are not real performances. Francis White is not giving, you know, a real
You
performance.
haven't met my sister, mate. All right. She's incredibly over the top.
Well,
Bloody annoying as well, I think.
she appears at the top of the stairs and comes striding out saying, "How dare you?"
Oh, she used that one once or twice, yeah. Mostly when everyone's having a good time. If Tony Robinson would be Cyclops, I'm guessing, who would Stephen Fry be in this?
I think he became Priam
Oh, of course he would, yeah.
because he the slightly buffoonish, probably slightly straighter character of those three royal family. He is the more normal of them, but you can see Stephen Fry doing that.
I mean, as the highest compliment that I think you could take this scenario and do a season of six Blackadder episodes with these characters in this scenario, leading up to the downfall of Troy.
I mean, if somebody wanted to in the 60s, they could have got most of this cast and done a sitcom because it would have worked. I think they've just stuck William Hartnell and the rest of them in and decided, oh, yes, sod it. Let's just have a really bleak ending.
But that's the magic, isn't it? The Doctor Who element and the TARDIS, you
What,
know, and
the magic of Doctor Who is a bloody massacre.
well, yeah, Jesus, how many? There's a plenty of stories, you know, especially in the mid-80s that ended with a massive massacre.
Well, the Legopolis ends the half the universe, and then
There
in
you
the flux. Yeah.
go. Well, quite, yeah. There's no universe left, is there?
It'll get sorted. It'll get better. It'll be fine.
We'll cover it with a line.
Thanks, Terence.
Well, look, we should probably, you know, because you and I could waltz around the mid-80s, you know, take a trip to Blackadder, but really what we've got to do is come back here and talk about the third episode of The Mistmakers.
Death of a spy of the and there's apparently a story behind the title which may or may not be true.
Oh, do you know the story?
I shall repeat the story as I understand it, but
Oh, well. Well,
shall we
count
kick
us in. You count
out of
us
it?
in and then tell us the story.
So 3, 2, 1.
Off we go.
There we go. So episode is called Death of a Spy, and Donald Cotton apparently said the title Death of a Spy was sort of forced on him, and it was like, but there, he then said, but there isn't a spy in the story, so they had to create the character of Cyclops just to be killed in this episode. But
Oh, wow.
there was no space for more dialogue, therefore that's why he's mute. But
Oh,
the Black Archive suggests that this is possibly a bit of a tall tale because they've got the early draft outlines and some of the original synopses, and there are spies in it more prominent in the story. So I think it's probably one of those, it's a good story, but it's probably not very accurate.
you know what is astonishing about season three? is how much of it, when you learn the behind the scenes, how much of it was improvised on the spot. Like they were pretty desperate half the time. Think about Dalek's Master Plan, where they only had snippets of scripts, and Douglas Cannon was just going, "Well, let me know what I, you know, where I can shoot, and I'll give you something." That's a good example of this. You know, the sort of the mistake around Maureen O'Brien leaving, Katerina in and gone, Sarah Kingdom in and gone. What's astonishing is how good it is.
It's better than it has any right to be at times.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those things. I think, oh, it was a while ago, I put a thing out on Twitter, and it was basically, you know, times where behind the scenes problems are apparent on screen. Because I think it was not long before after we did Underworld, because I think that's one of those instances where behind the scenes stuff is on the screen. I think with
Yes.
season three, there's, you know, you've got the star who's not getting on with his producer. You've got the script's kind of, you know, termination, underwriting his scripts, got all these behind the scenes difficulties. And then you've got obviously a bit of a revolving door cast. You've got revolving door, Donald Tosh goes, and then John Wiles goes, or you've got stories like Celestial Toymaker that's been rewritten about 50 times.
Yeah.
You know, but that, most for the most part, I think we can debate whether or not Toymaker's effective, but for the most part, this works. Master Plan overall work, Massacre work, and that's another one that was heavily rewritten. The arc work, you know, this is a really strong season,
Oh, it's my favorite Hartnell season.
but it nearly could, it so could not have been.
Yeah. Well, there are other times where, let's say, there is a distress feel to the show, like, Trial of a Time Lord and sort of 24 as well, where scripts weren't ready and, the things were going on behind the scenes. And, it's a reasonable result, but you can kind of feel it
Yeah.
sort of aching at the seams.
And the big difference is that we can't see a lot of that. So there may well be that there might have been things more apparent on screen. Maybe things were, you know.
I don't know, but then you get to stuff like the Gunfighters, which I think is a remarkably polished production.
And I was going to say that what we do have, because we've got three episodes of Master Plan, even though 5 and 10 are just padding,
They
really.
look great,
They
though.
are so well done. I mean,
There's
whenever
such visual inventiveness in those.
Escape Switch has got one of the most creative mixes, I think, in the whole of Doctor Who's history, when they have the shot of the sun and then it fades into the light on the Dalek Dome.
And less to say that the war machines, the direction in that is out of this world.
I think War Machines is quietly my favorite Hartnell. I think
Oh, really? Oh,
it.
this is this. The Mythmakers has edged right up the ranks. This might be like top three for me now, and I never would have said that before.
This deserves to be up there. This is such a strong story. And even though we can't visually get a massive grip on it, the fact that the script is strong enough that you can come away going, I know this story. I'm something like The Smugglers, where you've got, at least you've got tele snaps, you've got probably a few more clips. I struggle to retain bits of The Smugglers because I just find it, the script isn't as intelligent, and or the sound of it is quite dull. This isn't dull because one, you've got these massively heightened performances, but you've also got the music and you've got atmosphere. It almost works like a radio production.
I think, you can tell from the soundtrack that the performances are good. We know that the script is good. You can read the script, so you know this is a great story that they're telling, with pace and humor. Like, I don't think this would disappoint if it turned up. I even if it was visually drab, which I don't think it is. I think you can tell from the pictures as well. There's a bit of money in here. There's location work in here. Blah, blah, blah. I genuinely think this is a bit of a lost classic, and it is a crying shame it's taken me this long to discover a gem like this.
Well, I would hope that anyone who is listening out there, if you've not listened
Yeah,
to
get the
or
bloody
watched it,
soundtrack.
listen to it. Because the narrated soundtrack works. It's one of the few that just works by itself. Because certainly with like the Troughtons, because they're so visual, there's, you know, there are bits in some of the Troughtons where there's just lots and lots and lots of narration. But actually, I felt when I listened to this the other day that there's not as much at times. The script is doing all the work. the original recording's doing all the work. I think it's only really in the final episode when things sort of kick off that it relies more on having a bit of
On
description.
how it's, yeah, how it is visually.
But
Yeah,
it
that was the
doesn't.
one episode where I was like, oh, not seeing this is affecting my enjoyment of this.
And I think it will it would have looked really good. I just think from the bits we can glean and just the inventiveness of it, we are missing something very special, I think.
Can I
And I
say,
think
right?
yeah.
Well, I was gonna say, we're in the scene now, aren't we? Where, oh, this is the scene where he's talking about the catapult,
This is the
but we're
catapult scene.
coming up to the bit where the doctor's gonna say, very quickly, oh, well, have you thought of a horse? And what the modern sensibility, the very modern meta sensibility, is to hang a lantern on things, right? And that's exactly what Donald Cotton does straight away. As Agamemnon, oh, whatever his name is, Agamemnon, say, well, that's ridiculous. Why on earth would they take the horse in? Because it's what we're all thinking.
And you say that's quite a modern thing because if they didn't mention it, you probably wouldn't. We've been clever viewers going, isn't that silly? Go back to the Red Dwarf thing of like, how daft is that? But if you write it in, and you kind of go, well, yeah, they will do it. You and it, that kind of it's that meta sort of joke. I think Donald Cotton writes comedy brilliantly. And he gets comedy in Doctor Who well, and he gets the best out of the three regulars, even though Stephen and Vicky spend most of this episode in a cell.
The thing is, it's not people tripping over and doing pantomimic things. It comes from the characters. So he defines the characters and then he finds humor in them interacting.
And I
So.
think one of the companion pairings that only in the last few years people have started to appreciate is Vicky and Stephen.
They didn't get enough time, though.
They only had those three. And bear in mind, of the three full stories they do together, it's the Time Meddler and Mythmakers, and with Galaxy Four just sort of in the middle. But even then, one of the better things of Galaxy Four is the three
Their
regulars.
chemistry is out as well, especially in the Time Meddler. Actually, in the scenes now where they're in the adjoining cells and Stephen's sort of poking at her, going, oh, you and your new toy boy, Troilus.
It's the only time, because I don't think that you had it in Galaxy 4, because they don't really have a lot of time together in that this is their picking up their relationship from where it was in Time Meddler, where he's a bit sarcastic, he's not quite taking things entirely seriously, but and they're needling each other. They've kind of got that sort of
Brother sister, isn't
brother
it?
sister
Yeah,
relationship. There's
it's
a lot of
great.
sibling relationships going on. And Maureen O'Brien gives a better performance than the series deserved, considering what happened to her. Which, they've finished Galaxy 4, they finish the series, she goes off on holiday, she comes back thinking that okay, she's not a massive, she's a bit vocal in her dislike of working on the
Yeah.
show, but it
Well, and
was
she
wonderful.
says in the interview she thought she was slamming it in Doctor Who, that she just wasn't. And I don't think she was at all. I think there's moments where the writing lets her down. I don't know if she ever lets the series down.
No, she always does her best, even when some of the scripts are not great. She always is trying to make it work. I think what helps is Vicky gets retooled around Space Museum,
Yeah.
because in her what
Revolution!
first three or four stories, she's a bit Susan like. She's probably, I think in the Crusade, she's pretty much written as a child, and same
And
thing
in the
in.
Romans, we're like, oh, we're going to Rome.
And in Web
Woo!
Planet as well, she's written quite childlike in Web Planet, and then all of a sudden you get to the Space Museum, and she's written as slightly older, a bit more grown up, and that's kind of how she is for the rest of her time. And she's much better. She's fine beforehand, but she's just brute from the Space Museum on. She's just nailing it every single time.
What she has to get right in this story, and we ain't there yet, but is in that last episode where Troilus says, you betrayed us, and she has to convince him, no, I didn't betray you. Look, this terrible thing has happened. We've got to go, and I'm willing to build a life with you. And it's a lot to ask for one scene, and she fucking nails it.
He does. And it's like we're saying with Hartnell before, you've come back and you found out you've got four episodes and then you're out of work. And you could just go, sod it, I'm not gonna bother. But no, this is one of her best performances.
And then the next time we see her, which technically is Tales from the TARDIS, she slips back into that role effortlessly.
She does. I haven't listened to so much of the Big Finish stuff
Oh,
that she's
she's
done,
great. She's
but the
really
ones
great.
I think the Companion Chronicles, I think the Companion Chronicles were some of the best stuff Big Finish
For
did.
sure. Yeah.
I think,
It's still.
lean into the fact that you're audiobooks and stop trying to be cinema on audio. But anyway, that's another conversation.
Cinema on audio. Oh, I'm going to nick that one. Thank you. That's a good one.
And yeah, because I think was it Frostfire was the first one that she did.
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
And that just sets the tone, and she's really good. And the fact that she about stepped away from Doctor for so many years, and I think the because she was very vocal at the scripts. I think the story goes, or the legend goes, that because John Wiles was shadowing on Galaxy 4, he wasn't producing, but he was about to take over, and he either heard her or saw her basically slagging the scripts off, and that was the point he was like, "Yep, we're writing her out."
Well, to be fair though, the script for Galaxy 4, I mean, come on.
I mean, it,
The chase, I mean, I love the chase, but it's everything the show shouldn't be doing.
the chase is one of my favorite Hartnell stories
Oh no, it's so
for all the
fun, but
reasons.
it's
It
just.
remembers to be fun, but then that's what the whole Hartnell era was doing, is that it did different stuff. You've got the comedy. You've got the in just season three. You've got comedy. You've got the dark historicals. You've got the epics. It's some of the most. I think the Hartnell era is some of the most varied
Oh,
in storytelling, and it took chances at
I
times.
don't think there's another time where the show has as much scope as Hartnell's time, where they try as many things.
And I love the Troughton era. Second Doctor is probably my favorite classic Doctor, but there is no escaping the formulaic nature of, especially season five. And I think it works better when you watch stories in isolation. If you watch it and watch season five beginning to end, it's
Yeah.
like, oh, it's just the same story again.
Another intransigent base commander. Here we go.
And yet, season three, I think season three possibly got the most variety. I mean, it is pretty bleak.
In the whole of the whole of Doctor Who, you don't have as much variety anywhere else as three, I don't think.
I think does it it's possibly the season with the most stories in it as well, because there's a lot of four-parters, certainly in
No wonder he
season.
was exhausted.
I mean, because they stopped doing the long stories. Well, apart from Master Plan, I think they're all four-parters in this season, and I think that's to its benefit as well, that they are tighter. I mean, they could probably be tightened a little bit more now, but you don't have, and as much as I love a good six-parter, you can't deny that a lot of those six-parters are far
Too
too
long.
long. And season three, they're all just a little bit punchier.
I've got another question for you. How on earth did we get from you can't change one history, you can't change history, not one line in the Aztecs, to what are we going to do with this time meddler in the time meddler, to oh, well, here's the plans for the great horse of Troy. Go on, get your army in there and murder the lot of them. I mean, it's a bit
I
of a
don't know if there is an
turnaround.
explanation other than John
Donald
Wiles came in and thought, I'm going to do something different with these
Cotton's
historians.
a very naughty man, I think the decision is the doctor's got to be involved.
I think that the problem with having the he must stay on the sidelines, and I think you see that in stuff like The Crusade sometimes, is that the Doctor doesn't really drive the story. The history and the historical characters are driving the story. The Doctor and the Companions aren't so much, and they have to be either be written into a subplot or a
Yeah.
side plot. But like in the
It is
Crusade,
fascinating for that, isn't it? But it doesn't really feel like a Doctor Who story.
and the Massacre sort of falls into that trap a little bit, but then you've got the whole central thing of Stephen's the star of it, and and I think that makes good use of the fact that he's completely at sea of what's going on. He doesn't know anything of this history. He doesn't know what's happening. He doesn't know where the doctor's gone. And so it kind of works to its benefit a little bit, because at least it's still got Stephen front and center. I think there are a couple of historicals. I think Marco Polo's sometimes one of them, because I think the
Yeah.
main cast
It's Marco
complained.
Polo's story, isn't it?
And because I think William Russell complained, going, hang on, I'm one of the main stars here. Why is Mark Eden getting
Oh,
flight
why is he
sim?
narrating all of this? Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
and
actually, the Romans, interestingly, again hangs a lantern on it. Vicky goes, you know, well, this is all your fault, isn't it? And he goes, what's come back here, child? Why, you can't accuse me of all this, you know? And but they make a joke of it there, whereas he's explicit, it is his fault here.
I think there's a bit of that in the gunfighters as well, although they try to work against it because it's like he tries to stop the gunfight at the OK Corral, but I think they even acknowledge going, he's trying to stop something that they know happens.
I mean,
And I think the
yeah.
gunfight is a little less elegant with some of the bit in history,
They
but
have no part in the climax of that story at all. It's all about the gunfight.
and they try. I think there's like, oh, we could just write Dodo in, you know, the gun scene just to kind of at least
That
say one
she gets in
line.
trouble, yeah. But in terms of like concluding the story, they could be gone for
They
all.
could have left at that point. They
Yeah.
don't. They try to give it a bit of urgency because I know that, you know, the doctor goes out to the Clantons trying to stop the fight, but he fails. But there's no drama because we, you know, the gunfight's going to happen. So I think
But the
if
doctor's not just, he's not just instrumental in the climax of this story. He's the pivot in which the climax of this story takes place. Without him giving them that idea, the whole of part four can't happen.
an interesting thing, because obviously, you talk about, the Daleks, first Dalek serial, and there's all this thing about the morality of using the Thals to get the fluid link back, and Ian having those all those great moral debates about, we will not let all these people die just for, so we can get away. Flash forward 3 years, and I'm going to build the horse, and we're going to take it in, and it's almost completely different sort of moral compass of the show. Possibly is this because this is a comedy and therefore, it's a funny massacre.
Well, interestingly, the new series takes the same stance because think of Fires of Pompeii, like the Doctor is responsible for, you know, the fall of Pompeii. He makes that decision. But in the new series, we examine that. We examine the Doctor's reaction to that and the emotional consequences of it. Whereas the show just isn't doing that here. The Doctor's just in a sticky situation and goes, oh, well, try this. You know, like this might work. But like, and he's inside that horse with that army. There's no way he doesn't know this is going to end really badly if that horse is taken inside. It's a bit like the trolley problem, you know, the whole thing about you're in the trolley and do you go that way and kill one person or do you go that way and kill
Oh,
lots of people?
yeah.
And but you know, in this situation, the one person is the doctor himself, and the other direction is the entire, you know, the fall of Troy, and he chooses the fall of Troy.
And I think that's the thing. It's like because he knows Troy fell, therefore it's going to happen anyway. Therefore, it's very hot. It's very
But
hot
it
in.
wouldn't have fallen if he hadn't have done it.
But because history, but the myth said that it did. This is yet the myths and legends.
Yeah, it's
So
interesting, isn't
yeah,
it?
I think if we, it's one of those things, if you think about it too much,
Which came first, the myth or the action?
I think sometimes when it comes to certainly classic Doctor Who and everything, it's like some of it, you try to pull some of it apart, it doesn't quite hold up. I don't care. You just enjoy the ride.
I think ultimately Donald Cotton just decided actually the Doctor is responsible for this and just go with it, you know. But he does say, doesn't he, in the last episode, he gets a great line where his sister Katerina, it's almost like an inverse of the beginning where he's very happy to step into the role of God to get himself out of a sticky situation. She calls him a god and he goes, don't call me a god. You know, that's almost like his moment of going, I should never have gone there.
And it might well be that there might be something in the physical performance in terms of, because he has that confrontation with Odysseus at the end and they get away by the skin of their teeth and every, that there might have been a little more in the performance that we can't see
Yeah.
that would be that leaving Troy and, observing what happened, because there are bits where you may well have the doctor standing out the tar outside the TARDIS observing the fall of Troy, and it might not have been, I
It's
don't know.
so busy that last episode. There just isn't the time. Like, think of the Aztecs. You get that lovely moment where he's going into the TARDIS and he comes out and he grabs
The
the
brooch,
marriage
doesn't,
sim brooch. Yeah.
and that's a wonderful bit, because he could have, because if they just left it, he'd, very solemnly left a thing on the side and went, that would have worked as an ending. But the fact he just sort of, almost as a comedy punchline, sort of just steps back out and snatches it back up. And it's like, that's really well done. But as you said, I think episode four's got so much to do here.
You know what we needed, don't you? We needed, because the massacre does examine the doctor's role at the end of that story, and Stephen condemns him for it and says, "Well, I've had enough. You know, you're this cold about history. I'm leaving." Maybe he should have said, "Oh, and by the way, you know, do you remember that idea you gave to the Greeks a couple of weeks back? That was a shitty thing to do as well."
And I think that's there's a symptom there, because Stephen gets injured because Terry Nation's script for Dalek Masterplan has Stephen injured at the start. So basically, in a similar way that, oh, Vicky has to be in confined to the TARDIS at the end first episode, therefore that's why she sprains her ankle. It feels like things are kind of operating a bit backwards, because like the next writer said, oh, this is the status quo. So Stephen's injured and he's delirious. And I was like, so you haven't got that opportunity in those closing scenes where the doctor's a bit solemn, Vicky's left, to have what you get later in the massacre, which is, what did you do?
Yeah, it's a great scene as well. They ace that scene, the pair of them.
They do. And again, that confrontation is a great missed moment, because it's like, it's probably, it's not the first time someone takes the doctor to task, but it is,
Thank God we can hear it, David, though, yeah.
I mean, you've got Hartnell's performance in that. And I think it's the one bit of Adventures in Space and Time that was like, because they presented him as fumbling that speech. And I know it's, I mean,
He's word perfect in that speech.
he delivers that speech phenomenally well.
Obviously,
And
Tosh rewrote that script, didn't he? He goes, "We were so nervous about giving him that speech." He goes, and he just blew us all away.
Contrary to what people say, because there's always, you know, in the handbooks and say, and Hartnell fluffs his line because he gets Chesterton's name wrong, going, that's the bloody running gag. I think it was Hartnell put it back in. I read it, sure, I read somewhere that it was Hartnell who actually put that misremembering of the name in,
The
because
trope they
that's,
can lean on too much in Big Finish, though, I think. Like, he didn't fluff as much as they write. It's a lazy shorthand for the First Doctor, I think.
yeah, I think there are certain things they do as sort of lazy shorthand for the first, and he does fluff his line, but everybody fluff their lines, because I think Max Adrian has a couple of moments where he's stumbling over his lines a little bit. It's, but then we look at it now where everything is word perfect. Television in the 60s is a little more all over the place.
Listen to this conversation. Conversations aren't word perfect, are they? And in fact, some of the TV shows that let in some of the interruptions and things like that, I'm like, yeah, this just feels more naturalistic to me.
And it, and also when you watch, especially when they're doing some of these things and they're doing them as live and they try not to, you know, do any retakes, is how sometimes they have to cover lines or they have to bring them back. And you, especially when you can see it, you can see the actors working. And I think it's in the Black Archive that, or one complete history, one of them, where in episode two, Odysseus says, who are you? But he has it scripted twice. And I think Hartnell goes to the second response. So I think he and Purvis skip a chunk of
Oh,
dialogue in the
wow.
script. And you just, well, you just got to keep going, because if not, you're going to have to force a retake and you don't want to do that. And you just got to cover yourself. And I think there's not so much that in Doctor Who, but in other shows of the period. So, you know, certainly early episodes of things like the Avengers, there's l more than a couple of occasions where an actor has dried and they have to find a way of getting them back on script. And I think, I don't think of any, there's nothing in the Avengers, but I've heard that sometimes what they would do is that you can hear PAs queuing, giving a line in. I don't know any of examples, but I'm sure someone told me, say, oh, there is, oh, what's Dark Shadows, which was a US soap, but apparently quite, I've never seen it, but apparently that's quite notorious that someone's forgotten a line, you can hear someone giving a cue at times.
There's a wonderful clip of Honor Blackman doing a scene for the Avengers where the guest actor swears in the scene and she has a very tiny reaction to it. And then she covers it, and
She
you
does.
watch, and it's just so brilliantly
She
done.
does. I shared that on Twitter, and every now and again, people discover that clip, and it's quite because then my notifications start going a bit going, oh, they found
The
the
fuck clip.
quantum
Yeah.
test clip, the fuck, because someone came back saying he's not saying fuck, he's no. I've watched that clip more times because I like to be when I'm doing my research. Sometimes when I bother, it's like no, I want to be sure. We've just talked over the worst pun in Doctor Who history.
Oh, well, you said it earlier. Don't
We
worry.
said
Yeah,
it
we've
earlier,
covered
but
it.
it's a great cliffhanger.
It's a brilliant cliffhanger because we know where this is going.
And it's like
It's
we're
got
doing,
all of that inbuilt suspense, and we know a massacre's coming.
and it is building to it as well. It's not just that scene because you've got the bits outside the horse. You've got them looking up the model, which I think the model horse is fantastic. I love
Beautiful.
that model horse.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And so there is a
There's a
sense,
photograph of it, isn't it? In the sunshine.
because I think they took it on location,
Yeah.
so it won't be on the tiny model stage. It should look quite impressive. I think they actually shot it with the model city as well.
The very little photographic evidence we have of Troy as well. I think that set looks. I think this would have looked quite good.
And it's because it's the first story of the season or the production year, so everyone should be coming in fairly fresh, and they've had their holiday. This should look strong, because the rescuing the Romans from the year before, which was I think the start of the second year, they look really strong. They hold up well. I think this, the few set photos we've got, the model shot of the horse, the couple of clips, there's just everything pointing to this probably was really good.
What Cotton's done as well is there's a lot of characters in this. It doesn't scrimp on the characters, but through a series of very well done comic scenes, he's got us to like all of those characters in different ways, in ways that we recognize. The sibling rivalry, the dad who's had enough, the brothers that squabble, all these different ways. And so he's got us to a point where we really, really enjoy this whole cast of characters. And now they're ready for the slaughter.
You're not prepared for it. You can't. How many people would be watching this going, they're not going to brutally,
Yeah, something's
the
going to happen. The doctor
honorable,
will intervene somehow.
these wonderfully comic characters, they're not going to get massively slaughtered. No, they do. And the villain, if there is a villain in the story, if it's Odysseus, wins.
And even he, we even though he's boorish and he's a warrior and he's violent, he's funny.
He's
Brutus
got
the
some great
Wolf
lines.
is. I'm sorry, I'm talking about. No, I'm talking about Odysseus, aren't I? Ivar Salter's character.
Ivar Salter's,
He's really funny.
he is, and he's got that weariness as well. And he has that line to the doctor in the horse where the doctor's getting all edgy and is like, "You're like a, oh, what is it? At a, you're I'm going to find the line. I'm going to find
Yeah,
the line because it is such a great line,
go on. Are you
and it's
talking
a
about
line
the
that you."
talking about the orgy line?
Was it, upon my soul, you're making me as nervous as a bacchanite at her first orgy.
It's great. Oh,
And
it's so funny.
it's a sort of thing you wouldn't get now. It's the sort of thing they didn't do then. It's just a great line. And in Ivar Salter, because if you won't, most people will have seen him in Space Museum, or is in. Is he in Black Orchid? I think he's a policeman in Black Orchid. He's got a couple of lines. And I don't think anybody really rates either of those performances. He's the lead villain, effectively, in this story, a comedic villain, and he plays it spot on.
Well, I'll tell you who else plays it spot on, and that is Donald Cotton in the novelization. Are you ready for episode three's reading?
Let's go. Go on.
Okay. Because, said the doctor triumphantly, they'll think it's the greatest horse of Asia come down to save them. There was a long pause. And just how would they expect it to do that? Asked Odysseus, having looked at the plan from every angle. By frightening away the Greek army, because that's what it would seem to have done, wouldn't it? Oh, sorry, I'm elaborating now. Every one of you not required for horse constructing duty would sail away over the horizon. Ah, and only then come back once your horse is inside the gates. Precisely, splendid. I knew you'd see it. Well, how does it strike you? Asked the doctor, excited as if he'd thought of it himself. Now it's from Homer's point of view. What we writers really need is absolutely watertight copyright laws, but I don't suppose we'll ever get them. I mean, what a nerve. That's so funny.
I just love that they say hanging the hat on it and just acknowledging the absurdity of the whole situation, because it's like you've got to make it work, and it's either you ignore it and just go with it, or you just go, yes, it's this is nonsense,
It's
but
mad
go with it.
because we're having fun.
Well, not too much fun, because those Greeks are going to emerge from that horse of destruction,
I
and
know. We're either going to have a massacre or an orgy. So it's a dicing with death, but it could be fun. Sorry.
I mean, there's not many Doctor Who stories that will just pivot. I mean, I don't know if there's an equivalent where it goes from, being one sort of thing and tone, because I know they have like they have their tone meetings now, and you can just imagine saying, would we pivot from in the same story from being light comedy humor, bleak? Half the guest cast are butchered.
I think there's only two other examples. And the other one's written by Donald Cotton. And that's The Gunfighters, which has three very funny episodes and then a bloodbath at the conclusion. And you see that. I mean, you see how they're all just murdered in cold blood. It's really nasty. And the other one is, I alluded to it earlier, The Fires of Pompeii, which for its first half an hour is effectively like comedy historical, TK Maximus and all of this, lots of witty lines. And then in the last 10 minutes, it gets very serious.
And that ends in a similar way, in that you've got this town that's most of the population are quite horribly killed. And you just wonder how, especially because you watch that when you're grown up and you go, this is a very good bit of drama. If you're watching it as a kid and you go in going, oh, this is quite fun, and then it's like it ends horribly. And then, oh yeah, no, by the way, that actually happened.
History bites, David.
History is bloody harsh.
Well, I'll tell you what. Do you fancy going to watch the spectacular death of all of these characters we've come to know and love?
Should we find out what is it? Is there a doctor in the horse?